Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. The political junkie is up at the 10 o'clock hour, now in depth on what Vladimir Putin wants and what he's willing to do to get it. President-elect Donald Trump heard some evidence and analysis about Putin's ambitions and tactics on Friday when he got a national intelligence briefing. Foreign policy advisor and writer Molly McHugh recently wrote in Politico magazine, "This Russia does not aspire to be like us or to make itself stronger than we are. Rather, its leaders want the West, specifically NATO and America, to become weaker and more fractured until we are as broken as they perceive themselves to be." The question now is whether President-elect Trump believes that and how he manages a relationship with a leader he sees quite differently than many in Congress or the intelligence community do. If you have questions about Putin's goals and ambitions, his tactics and strategy, this is a good conversation to get involved and ask your questions. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. You can ask a question or make a comment on Twitter. As always, it's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest for the discussion, Molly McHugh, is a foreign policy and communication strategist. Her article in Politico is titled "Putin's Real Long Game." We have a link to it on our live page, and she's with us today from Washington. Molly, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Steve Sestanovich is with us. He's a senior fellow for Russian and Eurasian Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and also a professor at Columbia. You can find links to his recent writing on Russia on our live page as well. And he is with us from D.C. And Steve, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show as well.
Pleasure.
Molly, that's a rather startling statement that I quoted from your Politico article, and I want to understand it better. Putin wants the U.S. and our European allies to be as fractured and broken as Russia perceives itself to be. Will you put some more context around that?
Sure, happy to. I think this is there's sort of a key realignment in our thinking underway in the United States and in the West about how we perceive Russia, how we perceive Russian ambitions, how we perceive Russian goals in terms of their policy in the world. We've really had to refocus because of the discussions around the U.S. election and what.
Just lost Molly's line there, right in the middle of that. Steve, may I ask you to put some context around that, and we'll try to reconnect with Molly there.
Sure. The, Russia's always in the news, so we're arguing, as we periodically do, about whether we should have a good relationship, as Donald Trump says, or whether we should have a more contentious one. Molly has a good piece that argues we need to recognize that this is a competitive relationship, and that we can't really stabilize things unless we see what Putin is after. What he's after, I disagree with her a little bit that, he wants us to be as fractured as they seem themselves to be. They think they've rebounded from being really fractured. They think they're able to use power more effectively. They want to be independent and to be able to, dominate the countries around them. They want to be a large player in the world, and that means pushing back often against what anybody else wants. It means sometimes conquering, taking territory from a neighboring state, as they have in Ukraine. It means basically telling the rest of the world to shove it when we have disagreements.
Molly, I think you're back, and I think you heard most of what Steve said. He doesn't disagree with you about the competitive relationship. You hear him saying he doesn't think Russia perceives itself to be fractured and broken. So go ahead with what you were originally saying.
Sure, absolutely. Sorry about the interruption. I think there's a couple of things that are worth looking at in what Steve was saying. I do believe that the Russian goal is more clearly subversion than dominance, even in their own neighborhood now. And you see that the way they've been working in Georgia and in Ukraine and Moldova and the Baltic states. Their use of hybrid warfare tactics are much more common than the use of hard power, despite the hard power actions that we see. And I think that understanding this sort of new alignment in our thinking really really needs to happen. And I think until we listen to what the Russians say in their policy and in their doctrine, and we think more clearly about how they are viewing us, which is that they are in a war with us, which is that this hybrid warfare is something they are using explicitly to undermine our interests, we're still behind in being able to counter what they're doing to us.
When you talk about subversion, hasn't Russia always employed tactics to be subversive? And I would assume that happens in international intelligence work and in espionage. What is different about the way they're operating around that subversion now?
I think there's two key differences. One is sort of this realignment of all of their elements of state power behind what they refer to as the Gerasimov Doctrine, which is basically the use of every element of state power that they have, diplomatic, economic, cultural, information, criminal networks, intelligence services, toward state goals and state ambitions. And it's this kind of global imperialist insurgency where they're using state power not explicitly to build something for themselves, but to disrupt and subvert what is around them. And it is this goal towards subverting our interests, toward using our strengths against us, that has become, I think, a much more clear ambition in what they're trying to do.
Steve, does their goals around and their tactics around subversion look different to you than they have for a long time?
Well, I think they're sort of feeling their oats a bit. They think that the principal strength that the United States has had in the world over the past several decades, particularly since the end of the Cold War, are more vulnerable and more susceptible to attack with some of their tools than they have been in some time. And I think Molly is right about the kinds of elements of their strategy, what they're after. But you could put it another way to reflect a sense that the Russians have that we have some advantages that can be undermined. And that big advantage is, of course, that most of the countries they're talking about trying to subvert are closely related to us, either mm-hmm. as formal allies or wanting to be allied with us or as sort of in the orbit of the United States and Europe. And that, you know, over the Cold War and after the Cold War, that set of alliances represented the single biggest asset of the United States. But Putin thinks that this is a world in which alliances can be broken up, that you can get at them from inside, destroy their internal consensus, their links to Europe, to Washington, and that you can begin to make the world more disorderly. And in that world, Russia will loom larger because the United States will be shorn of its principal asset, that is, a network of friendly states.
A call here that I think follows well in what you've just said from Kat, listening in St. Cloud. Hi, Kat. What are you thinking about on this?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
So my concern, I have many concerns about Donald Trump, but my largest concern is the situation with Russia, and really just that it almost seems in some ways that Donald Trump isn't aware that Russia's interests are not our interests, that he's a bit of a witless ally to Russia, and maybe even that he's kind of fooled part of the American public into believing that. I mean, when he says at a debate that Putin has no respect for Hillary Clinton, well, yeah, I mean, that's the point. We don't need Putin's respect because they're not, you know, somebody that we necessarily want to be allied with. And maybe Trump's business interests or something like that are causing him to miss that.
Steve, what would you say to that?
I think Putin did respect Hillary Clinton, but he didn't like her. He thought she was tough. You know, people who visited Moscow in the weeks before the election found that the Russians actually were sort of toning down their rhetoric, and some kind of Russian commentator said the reason was they expected Clinton to win, and they didn't want to antagonize her. Mm. Putin has not had a good experience with Clinton. He certainly doesn't like her, but he does respect strength. I think Trump is very inexperienced in this field, and he's inclined to think that you can solve most problems in a kind of big guy to big guy way. you know, you sit down and you work it out. Right?
How practical is that, Steve?
Well, it can be perfectly practical in some circumstances, but, you know, in this, I think Putin would look at this guy across the table and think, you know, I've been in this business for a long time, and this guy is a new kid on the block, and I can kind of work him.
Mm.
I think what Trump doesn't appreciate is what Putin's weaknesses are, what his strengths are, and how to play them, and he doesn't really have a very good grasp of what the strengths of the United States are in international affairs.
Molly, I have wondered in reading a lot of this analysis if Vladimir Putin, you know, relishes the idea that President-elect Trump is openly questioning and for many weeks openly disdaining the intelligence that he was getting on Russian hacking from American intelligence agencies. And then I wonder, well, what are the deeper implications of the lack of confidence that Trump is willing to express?
It's a very good point, because this is really the space that, when we talk about Russian information warfare and their disinformation campaigns and the incredible state-funded apparatus they've built to influence opinion in the West and in the United States, this is sort of the part that's sometimes hardest to understand. There's never one clear story or one clear line or one clear goal that they're trying to sort of put forth in their media. It's a whole bunch of different things, and the goal of all of them is to say, the United States is no different than anyone else, that we are also weak and flawed, and we should question ourselves and our power and our ability to do anything good in the world, and we have no moral right to lecture anybody else or influence anybody else in the direction of their choices. And that's why you see the way that the Kremlin works. They recruit allies and advocates on the far right, on the far left. The fusion of those two things is sometimes hard for us to grasp and understand. It's the same in politics, where they sort of support causes on the far right and the far left. And it's basically anybody who is targeting the idea of the soundness of government, the legitimacy of government, the strength of government to solve the problems of their citizens, finds themselves in the target.
We are having a conversation this morning that I guess at the center is asking a question about what Vladimir Putin wants and what is he willing to do to get it. And of course, there's a lot of dimension to that question with these intelligence briefings and the intelligence analysis on the hacking and this relationship and some of the things that President-elect Donald Trump has said about Putin and what Putin has said about President-elect Trump. Molly McHugh, one of our guests this morning, she's a foreign policy and communication strategist. And we are working off an article that she wrote for Politico magazine titled Putin's Real Long Game. Steve Sestanovich is also with us. He's a professor at Columbia and a senior fellow for Russian and Eurasian Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And as I prepared for the conversation, I read a lot of what he's been writing over the last couple months. You can find links from both of our guests on our live blog page. I'm also giving you the opportunity to call in, talk to our experts, get some analysis about the questions that you have about this relationship. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. I'm on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. David asks on Twitter here, Steve, what are the fundamental narratives about Russia that are in tension between Trump and U.S. intelligence experts?
Trump is basically embarrassed by what he's been hearing from the intelligence community for a variety of reasons. They say the Russians were trying to get him elected. That's obviously embarrassing, because a foreign country shouldn't be interfering. He's in a deeper problem, because, you know, one can dispute intentions, but he's basically challenging the very idea that the Russians did the hack, got the information, and passed it on to WikiLeaks. And that seems to be a sort of firmer point. The intelligence community is also saying there is a broad challenge that's underway by the Russians to the credibility of Western institutions they undertake through their intelligence operations, through their propaganda, And Trump is uncomfortable with that part of the narrative because he wants to be able to sit down with Putin and kind of work out some deals, whether it's cooperating against ISIS or balancing China. We don't exactly know the details of his plans. But it's harder to do that if the intelligence community is saying, the starting point for this is you've got to understand Putin is trying to undermine the power of the United States and the unity of its alliances.
Molly,
so there are some big conflicts.
Molly, Senator McCain reiterated again over the weekend and said last week that he thinks the Russian hacking was an act of war. And in your Politico piece, you said what both administrations fail to realize, and I assume you mean the Obama administration and in the incoming Trump administration, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What they fail to realize is that the West is already at war, whether it wants to be or not. It may not be a war we recognize, but it is a war. What's unrecognizable about it?
I think it's these new tactics, this new shadow warfare that we're profoundly uncomfortable with because it's not really how we fight or what we view war to be. We're looking for tanks rolling across a border or planes coming over our airspace or missiles pointing in our direction, all of which Russia uses in the region when they feel like it. But that's not really the preferred means of doing warfare. And that's part of this new doctrine that the Russians have been sort of writing and testing and organizing in the region and beyond. There is this idea that this is the best way to move forward in achieving goals with the United States and against the West and against NATO. Nobody really wants to go to war. It costs everybody a lot of money to do it, and it's politically unpopular no matter where you are. But information warfare and subversion and use of intelligence operations and other means, especially economic and cultural means, these are things Russia has really developed a new machinery to use against us, and we're very slow to respond because we're very slow to identify them, and we don't have the same sort of centralized apparatus to analyze and sort of point our own response tools to stop them.
And that's what I'm curious about, is whether Russia is willing to use tactics because of the authoritarian nature of the country and of Putin's perception of what it is to be leading that country. Are they willing to use tactics that we will not use and maybe that we'd better get used to using?
The what should we do part is a huge question and one that many of us should be involved in discussing. I think absolutely Russia is willing to do things. The Kremlin is certainly willing to do things that the rest of us are not typically prepared to do against a lot of people. You know, some of it is the kind of big headline stories that we've seen, the invasions of Ukraine, the Russian support in the Syrian campaigns. Some of it is, you know, these campaigns like poisoning Litvinenko in London. Mm-hmm. A lot of it isn't death or destruction. A lot of it is reputational destruction. You know, you didn't need to kill Radek Sikorski, a pro-Russian or an anti-Russian Polish politician. They just needed to leak some recordings of him having conversations with friends that were politically damaging to him. They have all of these different tools that they use when they decide to go after people. And often we're just very slow to realize the source and the origin of them, as Steve was referring to sort of WikiLeaks and all of these apparatus that the Russian have built and helped put forward for information warfare against their opponents. These are things we need to identify clearly and to really call out what they are. I think when you're looking at Trump, and Steve was referring to his embarrassment about what's going on, I'm not sure if it's embarrassment. I think that no matter what happened in the election, no matter what the Russians were actually trying to achieve or do, no matter what Trump knew when or what his campaign was aware of when or not, you know, the Russians have now put forward this perception that they have some power over the president-elect and the future president of the United States. Their power is always in the shadows. And until the Trump administration or the Obama administration, before they leave, are willing to clearly expose not just the sort of general points about the Russian campaign, but how they actually did it, what that means, and really point out that the information architecture that they built is still there. If they decide to not support Trump, it's still there. If they decide to put forward some other storyline, they have the same means to do that and to influence American society and American opinion, and we need to pay a lot more attention to that.
A call here from Matthew in Minneapolis. Hi, Matthew. Thanks so much for waiting. Your question for Molly and Steve.
Hey, Thank you so much for taking my call. Great topic today.
Thanks.
I got a two-part question. How is Russia influencing our election? Any more embarrassing than what we've done in Argentina or Cuba or Venezuela or the Philippines? I feel like, first of all, we should be expecting it. And second of all, it's kind of like, you know, yesterday's news. If we're not trying to influence their elections, we certainly should be. The second part of my question is, didn't Ronald Reagan promise Mikhail Gorbachev that there would be no further expansion of NATO in exchange for an arms deal? And now, I believe Turkey shot down a Russian jet about a year ago, and I thought to myself, dear Lord, we're going to go to war because Turkey, a country that should not be a NATO member at all, is shooting down Russian jets.
Okay, Matthew, I've jotted down both of your points. Steve, maybe you'll take on the double standard question that Matthew's asking about.
Actually, let me just start with the historical facts,
because
Reagan never promised Gorbachev anything of this sort. There are claims sometimes that Russians will come up with that George Bush made or Jim Baker talked about something vague of this kind, but it's very hard to pin down, and it's pretty well established that nothing was ever very concretely said. Turkey should definitely be a member of NATO and has been for 60 years and a very responsible member with whom we're having a lot of troubles now. But a word about the double standards. You know, the cases that you're talking about are ones that are mostly from the Cold War, where there was a kind of global conflict, and both sides were very aware that how the internal politics of other countries shook out would affect the international balance of power, and that made it a pretty rough conflict. What Americans, in the way that Molly's been describing, are a little taken aback by is the discovery that that's happening now, long after the Cold War, and that it's happening not in kind of third world countries that, you know, where there are kind of shakier regimes, but actually right in the kind of the heart of, Western democracies in the United States, France, and Germany are places where, you know, all governments are beginning to worry about what the Russians may be capable of doing. So we see a little difference there.
Molly, I've heard some analysts who are defending Trump's responses on this say, everybody hacks. We would do it if we could. And this is kind of in line with what Matthew. We listened in on, the president of Brazil's phone. We listened in on the German leader's phone, Angela Merkel's phone. We do it if we can. They do it if they can. Maybe they're just better at it. What's the answer to that?
Well, I think on that particular point, the difference is maybe we are listening. I think certainly there's good evidence that there's extensive intelligence gathering happening from many countries, not just the United States and Russia, and sort of new technology and information tools and the internet and social media and phones have made this all much easier. The difference is we're not creating this giant information architecture to target and discredit our allies or our opponents or other countries that we're going against. In the way that the Russians are very comfortable doing. They've done these types of things in Georgia. They do it in Ukraine. They do it in Poland. They do it across Europe. WikiLeaks and the sort of Snowden-Assange collective have become a really key tool for them to do this because only recently has anyone been willing to identify them as clear agents of this campaign. Before that, this was sort of this, whistleblower, look at these truth-telling things that everybody was willing to repeat and put forward. The most important sort of piece of information that these put out was this kind of NSA listening campaign that infuriated our European allies and other allies and really helped create divides amongst our structures and our security architecture. And, these are very clear goals. So I think it's not, everybody listens, everybody collects intelligence, but what we do with it is very different, and we tend not to weaponize it in the same way.
So what if we were weaponizing it in countries that did not uphold the same kind of democratic values that we do. And I assume we do use tactics like this in places that we don't believe the leaders are leading with democratic values. Is that okay then?
You know, morally, it's hard to say one way or the other. I think, like I said, we're in a new landscape of warfare, and we need to look at the tools being used against us and what we can use in response. You know, I think part of what the Russians have relied on is this idea that, and you heard it during the campaign from Russian officials and others, this idea that, oh, who cares where any of this information came from? It's so important for us to reveal and tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
The same is true on the Russian side. Nobody knows what Putin and his top henchmen are worth. Nobody knows how much money they've stolen from them. Nobody knows what all of their wealth and assets look like. Nobody understands in Russian society how much they've actually sacrificed in order to create this Russian security state that is oppressive them and keeping them apart and distinct from the world. You know, that's that sort of showing people that that this is what we're up against is important, and standing clearly from the side of our values, of the values of the liberal democratic order, and that that creates better opportunity for our citizens and our people, and that we believe very strongly in that still, and don't question it when you're putting it up against something like the Russian state, that's very important.
Carlos, Steve online here from Carlos in Minneapolis. He says, as a first-time voter, I see one thing. The United States didn't do anything about Syria, but Russia got in there and got it done in 5 years. It depends on your version of what getting it done is, I guess. What are the guests' opinion about what Russia did in Syria? Good or bad, they took over. The U.S. also hasn't been able to handle the situation in Iraq. Steve, to Syria and Russia, if you will.
Yeah, I think the Russians, the main thing they showed is that when an ally of theirs is on the brink of being toppled, and that was in the fall of 2015, it seemed as though Assad was really beginning to lose the war. They came in and, you know, bombed the hell out of a number of Syrian cities,
mm-hmm.
And basically shifted the balance back in his favor. And I think it's one of the big goals that Putin had was to show we are a country that when, you know, you are our friend, we will do anything for you. He did this, Putin, in large part because he wasn't afraid that other countries in the region or the United States would act against him. And that, I think, it does represent a kind of calculation on his part that American power is, you know, American pushback, military pushback, was something he didn't have to worry about.
And Steve, that calculation, at least in that situation, turned out to be right, didn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I don't know quite enough about what the American role was in helping the groups that were, you know, that gaining the advantage over Assad. But it's likely that Putin thought, you know, this is another case where the United States is able to bring down a friend of ours, and we're not going to let it happen.
Mm-hmm. This is a conversation, if you've just gotten in on it, about understanding where things stand between the United States and Russia now, and looking back a bit to the Obama administration, but of course looking ahead to the president-elect Trump's administration. And the reason for that is he has been disdainful, sometimes contemptuous, of the intelligence that he's getting on Russia, particularly this Russian hacking during the election. What does this relationship between the two leaders and between the two countries hold? Steve Sestanovich, one of our guests this morning, he's a senior fellow for Russian and Eurasian Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Molly McHugh with us, a foreign policy strategist and working off of some of the things that Molly and Steve have been writing, including an article in Politico by Molly called Putin's Real Long Game. Good opportunity for you to ask some questions, some elements or dimension of the reporting that you're curious about that you don't quite understand. We've got some really great guests on that this morning. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. I'm on Twitter. I'll get to some of your your questions here on Twitter. It's at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. We'll get a look at the latest news. We'll be right back on the other side of that to your calls and your questions. Phil, what are you leading with this hour?
Hi, Kerri. There's word of a confrontation at sea between the U.S. and Iran. According to defense officials, a U.S. Navy destroyer fired warning shots at Iranian patrol boats yesterday as they sped toward the destroyer at the entrance of the Persian Gulf. The U.S. Navy occasionally has confrontations with Iranian naval forces in the Persian Gulf, but they do not usually reach the point of prompting warning shots. Iraqi forces are pushing deeper into the eastern portion of Mosul in their effort to drive out the city's Islamic State group captors. A senior Iraqi military commander says special forces have reached the Tigris River. The operation began in mid-October. The man accused of killing five people and wounding six at Fort Lauderdale's airport's baggage claim is scheduled to appear in federal court in Florida today. Esteban Santiago, an Iraq war veteran, is accused of pulling a gun from his waistband Friday and firing several times before running. Santiago flew to Florida from Alaska by way of the Twin Cities airport. The Supreme Court will not hear an appeal from three sex trafficking victims who accuse advertising website Backpage.com of helping to promote the exploitation of children. The justices today left in place a lower court ruling that said federal law shields Backpage from liability because the site is just hosting content created by users. There are weather problems on both of the coasts today. 10 inches of snow fell on parts of North Carolina over the weekend, and classes are canceled across the state today. Over the weekend, parts of California and Nevada experienced flooding, and forecasters are warning of heavy rains in the west through the middle of the week, along with an ice storm in Oregon. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:38.
On All Things Considered, breaking news as it unfolds.
We have the shooter in custody. He's unharmed.
And then the context to help make sense of it all. I'm Tom Cran. Join me here weekdays starting at 3.
Hey, if you find yourself only able to listen to part of these conversations, but you need to hear and know more, good news for you. It's all on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Kerri Miller on iTunes. Right now on the podcast, our bipolar disorder show, Science, in 2017, and my Friday roundtable on creativity and social media. Oh, you had a lot to say about that on Twitter. Check it out on iTunes. Back to our conversation now on Russia and asking, I guess, essentially the question of what Vladimir Putin wants, what he's willing to do to get it, and what the United States is going to do about that. Molly McHugh, Steve Sestanovich with us. Steve, I just want to bring up something that I read in a piece that you wrote for The Times in late November. And I think your theory was there are two Vladimir Putins. You say one Putin is, quote, confident, cagey, effective. The other is defensive, isolated, and unsure of himself. And I guess my question is, between those two Putins, which one is the more dangerous of the two?
Well, they're both a problem for the United States, but I think the strong Putin, the one I've said was Putin on a roll, is definitely the one we're seeing more of these days. That's the Putin who's kind of on the offensive in international propaganda and cyber hacking and in Syria, you know, dictating the terms of a ceasefire, bringing regional countries together, saying this is what we're going to do, still in possession of territory in eastern Ukraine. That's a kind of scary Putin. But there's also the Putin who's a little more on the ropes. You know, the guy whose economy is going into year three of a recession, one of the worst performances in the G20. Somebody who is, whose rule is a little bit more of a problem, more of, you know, has kind of legitimacy issues, who's, you know, shadowed by claims of tremendous corruption, and who is isolated in some ways in the world. We talk a lot about Russian propaganda, but for all that they've managed to do in Europe, 75% of Europeans say they respect President Obama. Only 15% say they respect President Putin. Mm. So there are disadvantages there for Putin in trying to get this new international profile. And my argument was President Trump, who wanted to figure out what to do, needed to understand both this strong leader, as he always describes him, and a guy with a lot of problems. And because if he wants to get a good deal out of Putin, if he wants to have a relationship that is on American terms, not on Russian terms, then he's only going to get it if he understands what Putin's weaknesses are.
Yeah, Molly, I'm interested in your thoughts on that, because it seems like the Putin who is defensive, isolated, and unsure of himself does things that have international ripple effects to try to shore up that uncertainty and that defensiveness and that isolation. And maybe that's the more dangerous of the two. What's your thought?
I very much agree with what Steve just said. I think most of us that have a background working on or around or near Russia understand the only way to deal with them is coming from a position of strength and clarity on the person that you're negotiating with. And our hope has to be that Trump will do that. I think that there's a lot of Kremlinology and a lot of Putinology and a lot of people who spend a lot of time analyzing Putin and his personality and what everything means. There's a lot of people with a lot more experience with him and working directly on Russia that I wouldn't override. I think everybody has different theories. I think if you go back to Syria for a second, and I think that question maybe warrants a little bit more of an answer. If you go back to Syria, you see the Putin that we now have. And I think that's the Putin that Trump needs to understand, regardless anything else. I think when you look at Syria, you can't just start in 2015. The Kremlin started supporting Assad, who is their only regional ally. They have a navy base that they're very protective of in Syria, starting in 2011 when the uprising against Assad started. They picked a side, they armed Assad heavily, and in the course of 6 years, they have changed the balance of power in the region. They have empowered Iran and terrorist groups to fight with them as militias in the war. They have exported their own jihadis to fight in the war and with ISIS. They have destabilized Syria and Iraq, and given themselves a beautiful narrative to use about the weakness of American power and the strength of Russian power. But it is absolutely false to say that Russia has created something better or stronger in Syria or the region. They've taken it apart. They've killed hundreds of thousands of civilians. They have not targeted ISIS. They have targeted civilian infrastructure, schools and hospitals and communities in order to drive people out and help fuel this refugee crisis that's really overwhelmed Europe. And there's this sort of smoke and mirrors aspect of his war that he's fighting ISIS and helping to provide security. None of that is true. They've used the Syrian war as an excuse to claim territory, to deploy a tremendous amount of defense architecture and capability to the region. And they now have a significant amount of sort of their own architecture there. They call it A2AD, the anti-access area denial sort of air missile, sort of anti-aircraft capability that covers the Eastern Mediterranean as well as the Black Sea, as well as the Baltics.
On Twitter, a listener here says Putin's bombing campaign was strategic in that it is sending hordes of refugees into mainland Europe. Jan called to say, I was in Prague in the spring when Russia invaded. What the U.S. has done in Ukraine and Georgia has backfired, has not been successful. I have no love for Putin, but he's accomplished a lot. Putin deserves economic respect, but not politically. Steve, you just told us that the Russian economy, and this is with the fallout of the price of oil, isn't it? Is in serious trouble.
Well, the Russian economy is very dependent on natural resources and commodity prices. So when oil prices go down, their economy weakens, and over the past couple of years, that has been a big problem. But it hasn't just been oil prices. Western sanctions, starting in 2014, have, by most economist estimates, taken a percentage point a year off GDP. And when your economy is under pressure anyway, or, basically in recession or zero growth, which is the situation right now, a percentage point is a big hit. I think it is not true, as whoever it was said on Twitter, that the response to Ukraine has backfired. I think you've had the Russians take a pretty significant hit of a kind that they didn't expect. They thought the West would essentially swallow it, and instead they got sanctions that have been economically painful. They've also gotten a significant kind of regrouping and revitalization of NATO of a kind that they really don't like. So I would say if you had to do a balance sheet for the Russians on Ukraine, there have been a lot of downsides for them. And, we talk about Putin being kind of on the offensive, but he's gotten a lot of pushback over what he did in Ukraine that I think would have to make that enterprise seem like, you know, much more questionable one for him. In Syria, I think that's another story. There he genuinely is on a roll. Whether he can sustain it is another matter. Whether he can keep with him a lot of governments that have been more inclined to lean toward him as the kind of, you know, the force of, you know, that has the initiative, that's another question. But he has definitely achieved quite a bit in Syria.
A call for you both from Doug in Grand Rapids. Hi, Doug. How are you thinking about this?
Yeah, well, just a little background to the question. I lived in the Caucasus region in Georgia and Armenia and Azerbaijan for 7 years and married a Russian and learned Russian language. And one of the things that, you know, the Russians always told me was that, you know, true democracy really doesn't work and Russia really needs a strong hand. And the whole narrative of the West is like, who are you guys to tell us what to do? Your democracy really doesn't work either. And now that we've elected Trump and it appears that that narrative in their eyes is coming true, I'm just wondering, is that irreversibly damaged in your guest opinions? And if not, what can Trump do, you know, to counteract that narrative that's so prevalent there?
Doug, thank you. Molly?
I think the most important thing, just sort of answering the last part of the question first, the most important thing Trump can do at this point is expose what the Russians have been doing, shake off their ability to use it to control or influence him, which is what they're clearly trying to do, to say they have a deep relationship with Trump that no one understands and that this will give them some power over the United States of America. I don't know what was happening, but Trump will be the president of the United States, and that comes with a tremendous amount of power and influence, and he needs to choose to use that in the American interest and not be sort of caught in this narrative that he's under the thumb of the Russian Federation. I think on the other point, you're exactly right that the Russians have used this to say this is proof that democracy everywhere doesn't work, and this sort of American crusade to make everyone believe that representative democracy and free markets and open societies is the way of the future was not true, but the way they try to portray it is that the last sort of 70 years or after the Cold War, depending on when you want to start, that this period of history, the Pax Americana or whatever you want to call it, is the anomaly, and that the real history is the history of strongmen, that you need central control and central leaders, and that the citizens of countries, given the choice, will reject the ideas of representative democracy and free societies and choose to have security and central control. And that's a very corrosive narrative. It's one that Putin and the Kremlin information architecture has been able to advance significantly following our financial crisis and sort of other crisis of identity and government that's been happening across the West. And I think he tries to make it look like a much more significant period or sort of question about history than it is. Our societies do provide more opportunity and defend the rights of our citizens better than any other systems that have existed yet. And every time he tries to question that, we need to remember that and push back and fight from that perspective for our values every day.
Steve, I was wondering what you thought of, and this was kind of a small thing, but it seemed important. When President Obama expelled these Russian analysts/spies a couple of weeks ago and closed down those centers, Putin announced very publicly that he wasn't going to retaliate. And it seemed like a clever decision designed to kind of stroke Trump's ego, as in, you know, and also to kind of diminish President Obama's influence. How did you see Putin's reaction to that?
I thought Putin's reaction was pretty cagey. I thought actually that both he and Obama did President Trump a kind of favor.
How so?
In the sense that Obama took some action to respond to the hacking, and that makes it easier for Trump to say, yes, that's been taken care of. Now other things we'll be doing quietly, covertly, but no need to trouble yourselves about that. And I think that will help him to push back in Congress, for example. Putin, by not responding, made it easier for or made it harder for American intelligence types and the Congress to say, okay, he's now responded. What are you, President Trump, going to do? Now Trump doesn't have to do anything. And that, I think, has kind of taken some of the drama out of what otherwise might be a kind of round of escalation. That's smart for Putin. If he wants to kind of let President Trump come in and have an easier path toward, you know, a kind of mutually respectful relationship, this was the smart thing to do rather than pick a fight.
Molly, I'm interested in if you were sitting on the committee for the confirmation hearing of Rex Tillerson, the nominee for Secretary of State. What question would you be asking him about Russia and his relationship with Russia?
I think there's sort of two different sets of questions there, and one is sort of the policy aspect. One is the conflict of interest or, personal connections aspect. I think in his rounds of pre-meetings in the Senate, Tillerson, the sort of, especially from the news that came out, was sort of using different lines. Part of it was this: Putin is a playground bully. We have to cooperate with him or talk to him from a position of strength narrative, part of which, I think we agree with, position of strength, very important. But this diminishment of Putin as a regional bully is also something that you heard frequently from the Obama White House. And I just don't agree that that's the truth. His perspective is not regional. It's very much global. Yes, he has a weak economy, but he plays a very strong hand. And I think it's important to understand the sort of expansiveness of what Putin is trying to achieve beyond its near abroad. So I think asking very clearly sort of what is the policy, because Tillerson was not speaking to that when he spoke with Senate offices. He would not speak for President or for a future President Trump's policy.
So you would very directly be saying to this nominee, to Rex Tillerson, what is the specifically what? How would you put that into a question? Because we're going to play some of this, and I want to be listening closely to see what they're asking.
I think the question sort of begins, are top military commanders and intelligence officials identify Russia as the number one strategic threat to the United States of America? Would you agree with that, yes or no?
Ah.
And if so, how do you see them acting against the United States internally and externally?
Steve, how would you put that into a question? Your greatest concern, yeah.
You know, a lot of this can be very easily dodged by a nominee appearing before the Senate. And I can tell you, I've had a Senate hearing of my own where, you had to deal with Senate questions. The problem for senators is to try to get something that's pretty concrete. And for that reason, I would say they ought to focus on existing or continuing policies toward Russia and say, are you going to continue the buildup of NATO forces in Eastern Europe to reassure our allies? You wouldn't want to be reversing that, would you? Are you going to continue the sanctions which have had A, B, C effect and have put Russia under pressure? You wouldn't want to reverse that, would you? I mean, I think the question is for Tillerson is, isn't just the broad atmospherics of a strategy or attitude toward Putin, but specific policy measures that other countries will be looking to us either to dismantle or to continue.
But, Steve, do you think that Rex Tillerson has that kind of clarity from President-elect Trump to really be specific enough to answer those questions?
Maybe not. But I think what you want, but President Trump is not at the hearing. It's the Secretary of State designate who's at the hearing.
Right.
And he's the one who's got to reassure the senators that we're not going to do anything to strengthen Putin and weaken our allies. And that's what a hearing can do, is put a nominee on the spot. And that's what the senators ought to be trying to accomplish.
Molly, what about that?
I would completely agree that asking about these specific benchmarks that we'll all need to keep an eye on in the next 6 months and a year, the renewal and expansion of sanctions, the continued defense deployments and sort of re-empowering of a vision of unified defense architecture in the Baltics and Poland and Romania, all of this is very important. And if any of that is suspended or stalled or rolled back, that will be a point of real concern.
Just a quick note here from Jane at the end of the show, and she's got a point. She says, what about the KGB? I haven't heard one person mention that Putin was involved with the KGB. Who is Trump dealing with? He's dealing with a KGB master. Molly, is that something to keep in mind?
Absolutely. I would definitely recommend that you look at my piece on Politico, because there's some discussion of that in there. This is part of the you know, long Putinology discussion sometimes of who he is and how he thinks. And I think that understanding that the state that has been built in Russia, the sort of new powerful Russia in the world, is a Russian security state. The core elements of it are from the intelligence and security services. That's how they operate. That's what they believe. It's not really a traditional state in terms of political power or apparatus. It is a security architecture internally. It's very important. It's also very important for Trump to understand, because Putin has training and tools and perspective that Trump does not. Not any slight to Trump there. They just have completely different backgrounds and do not speak the same language.
And the article that Molly wrote and that we've been talking about is called Putin's Real Long Game. There's a link to it on our live page. I'll tweet out a link after the show. And Molly, thank you very much for the time and the insight. Really valuable
for us.
Happy to
do it. Thank you so much.
Steve, how would you answer how you should understand Putin's background in the KGB?
It's very important that that's his career formation and training, exactly as Molly says. It's probably also important not to, exaggerate the advantages that gives this guy. He's, as I said, there are two Putins, and one of them is unsure of himself. Comes from a country with a declining economy, declining population, declining place in the world in many ways. And Trump ought to be aware that this is a guy who is trying to play, what is in many ways a weak hand well. And recently he's done it extremely well. But he's not a master of geopolitics, a brilliant thinker, conceptualizer. He's not a charming person. Trump, I like to say, Putin does not like tall people. And he feels very much at a disadvantage. He didn't like Bill Clinton for that reason. He didn't like Barack Obama in part for that reason, I'm convinced.
Yeah.
Donald Trump ought to be aware that he has, both in his own person and in representing the United States, some important advantages against Vladimir Putin. And he ought to not only be aware of them, but use them.
Steve, thank you so much for the time. This has been so valuable. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Steve Stastanovich is a senior fellow for Russian and Eurasian Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And a lot of his writing informed the discussion this morning. And I will also tweet out. We've got the links to his work on our live page, and I'll tweet out some links if you'd like to read further on that.